Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right. One more sleep and the Leafs start the regular season tomorrow night against the Ottawa Senators at Scotiabank Arena. Jim Ralph, Elliot Friedman to join us later on in the show. But today was the day that Ross Atkins, the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, and Mark Shapiro, the president and CEO of the Blue Jays, met the Toronto media, their usual postseason post-mortem. And, look, it's you're not going to get any answers 48 hours after the end of a bad season. I think in some ways the Jays are probably at the point right now, Richard Deitch, where they haven't even actually finished asking the questions, let alone finding the answers. But it was pretty clear that neither Ross Atkins nor Mark Shapiro were willing or perhaps able to answer what I think is the first most important question as we head into the offseason. And that is, simply put, how much longer are you around? What is your contract status? Will you be seeking or have you been offered an extension? Until we know that, I don't know what to make of anything they say, to be honest. I really don't, because if they're not here to affect the final stages or the next stages of this development, I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the answer to that question ultimately reveals how much faith ownership has in them in a long-scale plan, how much you know, Jeff, how much sort of authority and power they have to implement what they want. I have sort of a bigger question, Jeff. Like, I understand why this happens, and it's sort of, you know, sort of the history of professional sports teams to do these exit interviews or postmortems. But, like, do you find any value in them? Like, I mean, they provide, obviously, content and conversation and the Toronto Star and the Sun, et cetera. They're all going to write about this. But, like, at least, like, in listening to the Ross Atkins part of the postmortem, I don't feel like objectively there's nothing I learned today.
Well, free agency hasn't started yet, so you can't name players
a day ago. You know what I'm saying? Like, I get the process, but it's such a uniquely unsatisfying conversation, I guess.
Well, it's the same thing with every other team, though. I mean, Kyle Dubas and Mike Babcock do their year-enders.
Unless you have an organization or management that either is very, very forthcoming or transparent, or there's such a pressing question that becomes the sort of the conversation part.
Yeah. I mean, I guess. I don't know. I've covered enough of these. They all sound the same.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a rare one. You know, the rare one was, of course, kind of the whirlwind post-playoff news conference that Masai Ujiri had, firing Dwayne Casey and bringing in Nick Nurse and trading DeMar DeRozan. That was sort of beyond the pale. But you know, by and large, it's a way of, at least as much as you're able to, kind of putting a bow in the season for your fans. I don't know what anybody expected to hear from these guys. You can't talk about free agents because the free agent period isn't open.
Right.
You aren't at a stage yet where you can offer arbitration to your players. Can't talk about that. You haven't submitted. Nobody submitted their budget for next year. Can't talk about the budget. You're certainly, you know, unless you're going to fire a coach or get rid of the manager, there's not much else you can say. This to me was a postseason news conference from a team that was as bad as management, I think, figured it was going to be. And I mean, there's not much else to talk about.
No, listen, and again, I understand that you have to put a positive face on, and there's a bit of public relations aspect to these kind of postmortems. But, and again, this is, I wouldn't even call it mild criticism. It's just sort of more like, sort of what is the purpose of, you know, you hear Russ Atkins say something to the effect of, you know, I can't be more proud of where the organization is at.
But everybody says that. Come on.
Jeff, I get it, but like, you're at the end of the day, you are your record. And how could a, if you step back, if you're a business that lost $40 million, whether you have some really great young employees who may turn this around, how can you be proud of losing $40 million this year? Like, how?
Yeah, it's apples and oranges, though. I mean, yes. it's apples and oranges.
You're a 60 plus win team.
Yeah, but you're talking about $40 million loss in business. Nobody knows your employees. You're not selling your company based on your employees. It's a product. So your employees in some ways are irrelevant. I mean, all I'm saying is, you don't expect anything else at these things. You know, they did. I think it was pretty clear that they were. I don't think anybody was really happy with the amount of wins, but I don't think anybody went into this season expecting this team to win that
many games in management. I have my own internal sort of struggle because I think management is always smart to put out the best possible face.
You can't put that on
public.
This. You can't. I mean, but you see this.
But
this
it doesn't feel transparent. I guess is what I'm trying to say.
What should he have said?
We had a really disappointing year, and while I understand it was a rebuilding year, I'm pretty ticked off at the fact that this was our
That's
one
effectively
loss.
Effectively, what they said last.
This is
week.
Our win-loss record, and we're going to turn this thing around. And when are we going to turn this thing around? We're going to turn this thing around in 2021. I'm saying that today. That's what I'd like to hear.
I think you more or less heard that last week in several conversations. I don't think anybody said we're happy with the record. I mean, I know we're just kind of going around and parsing words here.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I just always laugh when people talk about transparency. But it's nothing to be transparent about right now. I mean, there just isn't.
No,
I don't even know, you know, have they had discussions with all their coaches? I don't know. But anyhow, this is Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro had their availability today. And Richard's certainly right. I mean, there was no... you know, there was nothing you'd want. There were a couple of interesting comments. Nothing you'd want to scream from the rooftops. But I thought two things in particular that sort of, I think if you follow baseball, gives you a pretty accurate reflection of where this offseason is going to go. This was Ross Atkins when he was asked about the urgency he felt or the urgency that was being placed on him to improve the club.
The way that we're viewing it is to, when we are in the middle of a sustained period of winning, we're going to look back at this offseason as a very important starting point to that. In addition to the core that has transitioned already, this will be a big moment in time this offseason for us where we've made another step forward towards building around that depth. It's just hard to do everything in one offseason.
I want to play that and then right away go to another clip. This was, I think, really kind of interesting, comparing what this offseason may be like to other offseasons. If you could play this.
Our offseason is going to look much more like the offseason following 16 and 17 than it would be following, or excuse me, 15 and 16 than it would be following 17 and 18. The overall commitment, the openness to different structures and term, the overall outlay will be more significant than certainly was last year. You know, having said that, I think to say that are we in on the very top tier players versus the guys that aren't on the very top tier, we're going to consider all those alternatives. There's value in every aspect of the market. There's value at the top ends of the market, and then there's values at the bottom of the market. It really comes down to picking the right player.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, to my way of thinking, this is Ross Atkins essentially saying that this offseason is more about building than ditching salaries, which, you know, that's essentially what they've done the past couple of off seasons. But, you know, I mean, the whole thing about top-end free agents is an irrelevancy because they're not going to sign any top-end free agents. And quite frankly, beyond maybe making a cursory call, I can guarantee you this front office is not going to waste a great deal of time trying to get in the Gerrit Cole sweepstakes. That's just not going to happen. But what I found interesting, Richard, is the idea that this offseason when we are hopefully in a sustained period of winning, we'll look back at this offseason as being significant. That at least suggests to me that they're going to do more this year than simply add a Matt Shoemaker or a Clay Buchholz, which, you know, let's see, the proof will be in the pudding. But that surprises me because I honestly thought that this offseason would be all about more Matt Shoemakers and Clay Buchholz, you know, and maybe you get a Jake Odorizzi or somebody like that. I'm just pulling a name out. I found that a little interesting. I don't know what to read into it, but I certainly do get the sense that there is an emphasis here in building.
Yeah, I mean,
or a desire, I should say, to build.
Yeah,
let's put it that way.
I think your sentence there, the proof will be in the pudding. You can't really evaluate that sentence or sort of thought process until we're in February and March and we see what additions were made in free agency, or whether they were able to get creative trade wise. The only thing I would say to that, Jeff, is what. What Ross Atkins thinks or what Mark Shapiro thinks are significant additions could end up being different than what people like us think or the fan base thinks. And, while obviously he looked terrific in his first couple starts, like Matt Shoemaker to me was not a significant addition. It was kind of a lottery ticket that looked like it might have paid off. Gerrit Cole, I agree with you, is that's just not going to happen. It's not realistic. So, does the level of like Odorizzi or Lance Lynn, like if they bring somebody like that in, I think that'd be a pretty good addition. We'll see if they get to that. I don't know how you'd sort of say it, like upper mid-tier kind of, free agent acquisition.
Yeah. I think Shai made the point on Sunday that I think what the Jays are looking for in terms of starting pitching is stability. And you define stability by the ability to give you innings, by reliability. It doesn't necessarily mean somebody's going to come in and win a Cy Young Award, but it could mean somebody who's going to come in and give 200 innings.
Right.
And I think that's what this rotation needs, some stabilizers, because they don't have one right now.
Yeah.
None of the young guys are going to stabilize your rotation. They just aren't.
Well, 39 starters, right? I mean, Trent Thornton all due respect to him, he can't be your best pitcher.
Like, no. Trent Thornton.
You have no chance. None.
If anybody who pitched for the Blue Jays this year starts an opening day next year, I might not go to any games. Ross Atkins was asked about his contractual status, which... Now, this gets interesting. We have been led to believe that he and Mark Shapiro have another year left in their contract. We've been led to believe that at some point in the past 2 years, an approach was made to extend both people for multiple years. I don't know where that has gone. Sunday, there was someone just asked me, well, how do you know Ross only has a year left? Because we never really, there wasn't a news conference for his contract. I mean, it was kind of a release saying that he was given an extension. There was, we just sort of operated under the assumption it was 1 year. So, I mean, there's a lack of clarity in terms of the front office. But this was Ross Atkins when he was asked about his lame duck status.
I wasn't aware that was a term in my contract. I better go back and check it. So I really don't think about it that way. I think about how we can improve and get better, and I couldn't be more proud of where this organization is today, Steve. It is in good shape, and the future is bright. It's just really difficult to do something exceptional and spectacular without some sacrifice. And we've weathered some storm and been through some sacrifice, and now we're focused on improvement and getting better.
So there was really no answer there as to his status, and again that look, I can tell you, agents are going to want to know. No one's going to sign here if they don't have an idea that the general manager and the president are going to be back. This was Ross Atkins. I probably the most interesting thing he said, to be honest, because this is the first time anybody in the organization has not only come out and said Bo Bichette is our shortstop, but come out and said we think he's a really, really good shortstop. Dylan?
The short answer is he overcame some mistakes with range. The range was so good that it made up for some of the mistakes that I don't think he'll be making in the future. He is the type of person and athlete that doesn't make mistakes twice or often. So the range, the arm strength is there. The range is clearly there. The hands are definitely there. His exceptional footwork. Now the timing of who's running and when to get rid of the ball, and then the consistency of transitions for him and fielding the ball on different surfaces, we're confident that he's going to be an above-average defender.
Okay, that's something no one's ever suggested to this point, which it's interesting that I think more time was spent talking about Bo Bichette than Vladimir Guerrero Jr., by this front office. That to me is intriguing, just because even halfway through this year, even when he was up, a month ago, if you talk to baseball people, can Bo Bichette play short? They go, yeah, but you may want to eventually look at moving him off to second base, depending on yada yada. It's pretty clear to me that this front office at least views Bo Bichette. To hear somebody call his defense above average, as I said, you would not have heard that last year.
Yeah, that to me was an interesting answer, Jeff. Like, that's sort of specifics, projecting an important player on this franchise into philosophically what you think of him and at what position you think of him. So, whether you agree or disagree with Atkins' assessment of Bo Bichette, I actually like that exchange that he had with the reporter who asked that question. And I think, Jeff, you would agree, they're in a much better position if Bo Bichette can be a long-term shortstop, because second base is a position, one, you can find, two, you can play around with, finding shortstop, center fielder, catcher, not always easy. And so it would make life for them much easier. And I think based on the eye test, I thought Bo improved as the season went on defensively.
Yeah. I there's nothing this kid does would surprise me, because I really do think he is one of those players who just decides, I want to get better at this.
Yeah.
And then he gets better at it. And
he seems driven. We'll learn about Vladdy too.
Yep.
But Bo Bichette seems driven to be great. And I don't know if that's a product of being part of a athletic family. I don't know if that's just something the kid was born with, but you know what I mean? It's such a cliche.
But it's accurate.
He has it. Whatever it is, he has it. And I don't think this year was a mirage. I think this is what he's going to be.
No, you're absolutely right. There is something about him when you see him play. There's something about him that it's the it factor. I think that's the best way to put it. So then Mark Shapiro took the stage, the president and CEO of the Blue Jays. And this was probably Mark's most interesting answer, was asked about the off-season direction of the team. And, at some point in the next couple of weeks, there will be a meeting with management and they'll set the budget and et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the statement was something that I think gives you a little bit of insight into how this team views what it saw happen around itself in Major League Baseball this year.
Well, I think that's a big part of the offseason analysis. Today is kind of the last day of thinking about this past season. The next 3 weeks involve a series of meetings, Ben, that will work towards determining objectively where we look at next year with just the core in place and then what the additions mean. So, using those firm wins is more just kind of an illustration that every win's not equal. Some wins are more meaningful than others. I think looking at other teams, even in recent history, San Diego, Philadelphia, that added big name free agents, it's kind of thinking about, are we looking to win the offseason, or are we looking to kind of take that next leap for this team? So we want to take that next step, moving from competing to winning. What those opportunities are and when they present themselves, we have to be prepared starting this offseason.
Which I found interesting about that is sort of the reference to the San Diego Padres and the Philadelphia Phillies. Of course, the Phillies went out and added Bryce Harper. Didn't make the playoffs. The Padres added Manny Machado, didn't make the playoffs. What I would say there, though, is the San Diego Padres were very clear. They weren't getting Manny Machado necessarily to put him over the hump this year.
Right.
They were getting Manny Machado because he is going to be an important part of that team for the next 6 years when their young players are going to develop. Bryce Harper was a little different. I think this is where I kind of agree with Mark. There's a danger, I think, in misreading your window of opportunity. There's, quite frankly, I think a danger these days, especially now that the game is skewing so much younger, in going all in the way the Phillies have done. And I think Mark kind of views those as cautionary tales. Again, I'm not sure I agree with the Padres, because fundamentally I have no problem with what the Padres did. They got a 26-year-old middle infielder who's going to be a great hitter probably for the next for the term of his contract. It's not like they went out and signed a 30-year-old dude with a history of injuries. But that the suggestion that they are aware that there is an aspect of timing here involved in this, and that you may not go out and spend all that money at once, I found interesting. I don't know if I agree with it completely, but it does give me an insight into how they're thinking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, win the offseason, a little bit sort of cliche. Like, you know, if you were a Padres fan or a Phillies fan, you were incredibly excited about all those additions, and that you probably, you know, many bought season tickets for that. But I'm with you, Jeff, and I didn't like the Harper contract when it was signed. I think that's going to turn out to be a little bit of an albatross. Yeah. The Machado one, though, totally makes sense.
Right within the ballpark.
I mean, they're going to time that perfectly. He's a young guy. That they have a great farm system. I think if you're a fan of this team, of the Blue Jays, and you're hearing Shapiro say that, I think what you really want is that when, like, Jeff, like a Patrick Corbin type of pitcher or John Lester type is on the market, just to sort of be in the game. You may not land that pitcher, but I think, you know, if these guys are going to be serious about sort of building, that's to me the kind of free agent you at least want to make a pitch for. I think this fan base is very realistic that Bryce Harper and Manny Machado and, you know, he didn't get the free agency, Mike Trout, Mookie Betts, you're not going to be in those conversations. But, you know, if this front office is going to talk the talk, I think it's very fair in this market to be involved in the kinds of conversations with front end starters. Maybe not the highest level Max Scherzer, but you know what I mean?
Like, well, Patrick Corbin's high level.
Okay, so how about like the B's as opposed to the A's? I think that's realistic.
Yeah, you know, I always caution this, though. You don't know who teams talk to.
Correct. Right. We don't know.
I mean, you never do.
We don't really know. Reached out to Bryce Harper.
You know, there are people in this city who will go to their grave thinking that the Jays were players for Yu Darvish. They weren't even in the ballpark.
Right.
Turns out I don't get worked up about whether or not a team makes a play for a free agent, because I don't know whether or not I believe it. I mean, if I'm a general manager, I could tell you, yeah, we made a call to Gerrit Cole. We were really interested in Gerrit Cole. You have no way of knowing whether or not I'm lying. You just don't.
Right. But at a certain point, do you agree that they're going to have to bring in, they're going to have to spend for quality starters at some point?
Yeah, they this year, and I said this at the time, there is absolutely no reason when Dallas Keuchel was out there in the market that they should have gone hard at Dallas Keuchel. They should have offered him a multi-year contract to get him in here. Okay, maybe he's not going to come here because Dallas Keuchel played his cards pretty well.
He wanted to be with a contending team. Yeah.
But my point is, when somebody like that comes along, absolutely, because there is going to be no financial comeuppance based on Bo Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who is under contract for the next couple of years at a below market rate, Vladdy Jr., Kevin Biggio, Jordan Groshans when he's up here. This is going to be a thoroughly manageable payroll for the next 5 years.
Totally.
I mean, if you want, you can offer Vladdy Jr. multi-year contract, but you don't have to do it. You can go year-to-year arbitration by arbitration or arbitration to arbitration with them. So you can spend money in free agent pitching. Absolutely, you can spend money in free agent pitching. But again, I never get worked up about that because my experience has been both agents and teams BS a great deal when it comes to whether or not they are involved in a market for any player.
I'm just saying that, like, the market is big enough to go after a certain level of free agency, and I think the fans are realistic about not competing for the Mookie Betts's, but I don't think, you know, I would like to see in the next 24 months a starter, like you said, who can really be a 200 innings type of person, you know, with an ERA under 4 and a chance more than not to give you wins, who can get you a ton of quality starts. And and you are correct, Jeff, in the sense that the payroll exists now where that is eminently doable, if not two of those types of pitchers. And then, of course, the hope is that Pearson and Manoa and some other young arm, Barucki or whoever, sort of forges your rotation. And then you have a real shot because you have these incredibly gifted offensive players, Jeff, who you are not going to be paying big dollars. Again, we're talking long term. I think the Blue Jays, whoever the front office is going to have to make a decision, I think, at some point on, like, Vlad and Bo. Do you try to sign them?
That, even if you do, that's not going to be, we're not looking at $200 million.
No, I agree, but I'm saying in the next couple of years, do you try to pull a 7-year kind of deal, or do you just play it out until they ultimately get to free agency?
Yeah, but I mean, either way, even if you do, if you sign both of them to 6-year deals, you've got enough money to do that.
Yes.
You've got, there is no big nut coming down the road. There's no sort of Josh Donaldson, right, verging on free agency that you necessarily
some
have
of that'll
to worry
be about if they want the security. Who is the Braves guy that's signed really for under market for a long term?
Ronald Acuna.
Yeah, so it will be interesting to see.
And Ozzie Albies.
Ozzie Albies was I thinking of. Yeah, that was a really good team friendly deal.
Mark Shapiro was asked about the current status of Rogers Center renovation. There's really nothing to say there. If you've seen the Rogers Center, they are effectively putting a new roof in the place. God knows it needs it. The Rogers Center renovations, and I know this drives Mark nuts. I mean, he's not responsible for it anymore. Ownership took that off his plate. So he's got nothing to do with Rogers Center renovations. Whatever is being done there is part of probably a larger real estate play or something on the part of the folks here. But there you go. That was a selection of the Atkins and Shapiro clips from their media availability. Shai Davidi will join us at 6 o'clock. Both men kind of peeled off and did one-on-ones and I guess sort of off the record, things with the writer. So Shai will join us at 6 o'clock. Maybe we'll get a little more insight and a little more accurate parsing from Shai Davidi about what was said. We mentioned the Leafs will open their season tomorrow night. Hockey Central tonight gets you going at 6:30 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Puck drop is just after 7. Leafs Nation postgame with Gord Stellick immediately following the Rays-A's game tomorrow night, the playoff game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. One more sleep, and it's the Senators and the Leafs at Scotiabank Arena. Jim Ralph, our Leafs radio analyst, will join us. It's primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Right, it's primetime sports. Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch. The Leafs will open their NHL season tomorrow night against the Ottawa Senators. Puck drops at 7 on Sportsnet Ontario. Leafs Nation postgame on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Immediately following the A's-Rays playoff game, it'll be Gord Stellick and Nick Alberga doing the duties at the conclusion of that particular AL wildcard game. The National League wildcard game goes tonight. The Milwaukee Brewers in Washington to take on the Washington Nationals. Coverage begins at 7:30 p.m. on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet Ontario. Brandon Woodruff on the mound. for the Milwaukee Brewers, Max Scherzer for the Washington Nationals. Let's bring in Jim Ralph, our Leafs radio analyst on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Jim, how you doing, man?
Good, Jeff Blair, Richard. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. So I got this idea. It's not original. It's from my friend Kevin McGran of the Toronto Star, who put this out as a Twitter poll yesterday. And he said, how should the Leafs go about presenting their captain? And one of the options was just let John Tavares skate out to the ice during player introductions tomorrow night with a C on his jersey. Subsequent to that, my friend Jeff Merrick tells me that Kyle Dubas is apparently a big wrestling guy. So this would be like a vintage WWE thing to do, would it not? Just have him skate out with the C?
Yeah, I mean, you didn't think they'd wait till the day of the game anyway to announce it, you know, with the importance of a season opener and getting off to a fresh start. And you'd think you'd let somebody ease into it for a couple of days before the start of the regular season. But we're down to two options, that one or morning skate tomorrow. you find out.
That would be intriguing. Ralph, you've been around this team more than anybody. Does this team need a captain? Like, I'm not talking about the sort of general, every hockey player I've talked to, Richard, every hockey player we've talked to in this studio has said, yeah, it's important. So I'm going to assume it's important. But you're around this team an awful lot. Would it change anything fundamentally about this team?
Well, I think where it's different here, and maybe in some other markets as well, is it's not just the leadership and in the dressing room and, you know, you have to perform to a certain level on the ice all the time for everyone to follow. And remember Jim Bouton's book? He said, you can't chirp in the dressing room if you're not going well.
Exactly.
If you're 0 for 73, you can't say, guys, we got to shorten the swings. We got to make contact. Everybody's going to look at you and say, come on. So there's, you know, you realize there is the on-ice part of it that you have to be pretty good on a nightly basis. But I think from a Toronto standpoint, you got to be the guy that comes out after the tough losses, the times that you don't want to go out. And I think that's where, as much as Dion Phaneuf was criticized at times in Toronto, he always took that role.
Yep.
You know, he always came out and faced the music. So I think, you know, if you get a guy that's not really into that part of it, it's a problem. Because then, you know, you start to get a little bit of a negative feedback from the media and that trickles down to the fan base. So I think as much as it is what somebody's accomplished and what their leadership skills are in the dressing room, there's that 50% other side of it, which is get to the microphones and explain what happened.
First of all, I love finding out that Kyle Dubas is into wrestling. See, what I would do is I would have John Tavares
rappel down
from the rafters, like
Sting. Somebody else suggested
in the WCW. That's how I would do. That would be incredible. All right.
Yeah. See if you can time it for the opening face-off too.
Although Jim, I got to be honest with you. Jim's probably a lot of liability issues with my plan.
All of a sudden he's face down and Austin Matthews is a C on his jersey in the second period.
So much for the season. I think one of the things about this year's roster, Jim, is the balance between offense and defense is much, much better than it's been over the past couple of years. How do you see that sort of particular thing, the balance of this group?
Yeah, with Tyson Barrie, obviously, is an elite player. So when if you've got Barrie playing with Jake Muzzin and Riley with Cody Ceci, that's a pretty solid top four to start. And I imagine at some point you're going to ask about Sandin and the preseason that he's had. But while you're waiting for Travis Dermott to get back, I think you're pretty happy with what you've got. Puck moving defenseman, which has always been big for a lot of teams, but I think especially for Kyle Dubas and the type of team he wants to put together. And if you can get those guys that can make the 30-foot pass out of the zone, all of a sudden the forwards look a lot faster. So I'll agree with you. There seems to be more balance now. And the only thing they've got to guard against is, you know, the first three games are against teams that you think they should be better than. But if you go back to last year, you could get a pretty good knuckle wrapping early on in the season.
Jim, I'm glad you brought that up, because I saw Brian Burke and Jeff Merrick talk about this on Hockey Central, and that's the schedule. The first couple games, obviously, certainly against the Senators, manageable. But if you look at the first 12 or 14, it's a pretty tough go. And I wonder, when you've looked at that schedule, I feel like we're going to know a lot about this team over the first month.
Yeah, and we're going to know a lot about individual players, too, the guys that surprised in training camp. And last year, what was it? They opened against Montreal. It took overtime to win. And then they, you know, they lose at home to Ottawa before winning four straight on the road. So, it, you know, I think even you go back to the preseason, Ottawa never really had much of a lineup and beat the Leafs in back-to-back games. So the positive is the Leafs got better as preseason went on. But you're right. I think the second week you've got St. Louis and Tampa both coming in. And if you're, you know, off to a 1-2 start with Ottawa, Montreal, and Columbus, all of a sudden, you know, it's you may not be as good as everybody, as we're talking about them, expect them to be.
You know, and it's not just the opponents, but you look at the pacing, or the spacing of the games. It's essentially a game every other night for the most part. And I think that was Brian, you know, Brian's comment on the Hockey Central preview show was like, first of all, none of the West Coast teams are going to be, you know, going to be crying for the Leafs or any East Coast team when it comes to travel. But I what interests me is this is, to me, where you are going to have to practice some load management with Freddie Anderson. I think this is a perfect opportunity to do with so many games so quickly, yet in kind of a pattern, right? You can almost see how you might want to give Freddie maybe a couple of days off in the first eight games, even to the first six games.
Yeah, and hopefully Michael Hutchinson is sharp enough that it's not just the second of back-to-back.
Yes.
You know, I think that's, you know, that's where you make up the rest time for Freddie Anderson. I know a lot was made out of Tuukka Rask in Boston, only played 44 games last year. His lowest total in a number of years, and he took them to the Stanley Cup Finals with his best playoffs. So I think that's got to be there. But Mike Babcock made a good point. He said, it's great to say we're going to give Freddie Anderson a lot of nights off, but we've got to make sure we're in a position where we don't have to win games all the time with our best lineup. You know, that you can't be a 500 team in November and say, okay, Freddie's got a night off against Ottawa or whoever it is you're playing. He's still going to coach probably as much to the standings as he is to the goaltender's capability. Mm-hmm. But one thing I thought was great, and you sort of store it away for a little later, Hutchinson was so good in Montreal against the Canadiens in preseason, in a 3-0 shutout. Three of the four games against Montreal are this year the second game of back-to-backs, including both games in Montreal. So you'd like to think that's maybe a little confidence boost there for Hutchinson when, you know, he does get the games.
Jim, we've got about 90 seconds. Let's eliminate Freddie Anderson from this, who I think both Jeff and I agree is the one player who cannot get hurt. Who to you on the Leafs is the key player in terms of maybe them sort of reaching a certain level that at their ceiling they can reach?
William Nylander. I think you've had the consistency with Matthews and Tavares. Hopefully Matthews can stay healthy for a full 82 games. Marner, I think, you know, be a 90-100 point guy again this year. You're happy. Nylander's the guy to me that's got to step up to show they've got at least four super elite forwards. And you do that. That's, you know, even Tampa's hard pressed to match that.
Ralphie, we're going to let you run. Should be a fun season. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Jim.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Jim Ralph, our Leafs radio analyst on Sportsnet 590.
That's a good take. I think he.
Yes, it is.
I think Nylander is. I mean, it's so sports cliche, but that's the X factor this year. He's the guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think without question, if he elevates his game to where it was a couple of years ago, based on what we've seen from Kasperi Kapanen, and suddenly those are the two.
And power play two becomes nasty.
There's no team in the NHL that has two lines that can match those two lines. We mentioned 7 o'clock is the puck drop tomorrow on Sportsnet Ontario. Elliot Friedman, NHL analyst with Hockey Night in Canada and the NHL on Sportsnet, will join us. It's prime time on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Yeah, it's a podcast, but we're still not going to let him swear. Subscribe to Tim and Sid at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. They have more writing awards than you. Unless you're also an award-winning writer. Jeff Blair. Richard Deitch. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The IAAF Track and Field Championships continuing in Qatar. And if you've seen any of the footage, Richard Deitch, my first question is, the empty stands, the boondoggle that this has been, got a World Cup going to Qatar. If I'm FIFA, now FIFA's not going to worry about anything because they've all, the money's, they've all got their money. Exactly. But my God, if I look at, if I think about what I saw, and by the way, that was an Amber Alert.
Yep.
If you look at what I saw, or you think about what you saw at that, at the IAAF championships, as I said, I just wonder what's going to happen at the World Cup.
Well, you hit it on the head. The IOC and FIFA do not care at all about this beyond getting their own coffers filled. But these optics, Jeff, are awful. Both of us are major track and field and Olympics fans. And this is a, you know, this is a remarkable event in terms of the level of athletic talent that exists. And to see those empty seats is a really, really bad look for world track and field. But this is sort of the devil's, you know, agreement that you make when you go to a place like Qatar. The World Cup probably will not be empty, but, you know, we've talked about this before. The temperature and the heat are going to be oppressive. You've seen all these horrific human rights violations already in terms of the buildup of this. So, you know, these organizations make deals with the devil, and part of that deal you're seeing are the empty seats.
Andre DeGrasse ran today in the men's 200 meters and finished second to Noah Lyles of the United States. And this is a call of the race, courtesy of our friends at CBC and the IAAF.
They're away, and look out for Lyles. He'll be on the shoulder of Jamini, who did go off pretty well. I think DeGrasse has gone off pretty well as well. If they come round towards the home bend, Lyles has got a little bit of work to do here because DeGrasse and Jamini are on it. Look at how close this is as they come down the home straight. Now the strength of Lyles. Lyles is coming through. He's the world leader. He's the world champion. 19.82 seconds. And Lyles, on the big stage, has answered the question. He can deliver. And he's the world champion here in Doha. Lyles had to show some strength.
There you go.
Excellent call, by the way.
It's a tremendous call. Quality call. So Andre DeGrasse gets a silver medal behind Noah Lyles. And this is, you know, something Anson Henry and some of the track and field people we spoke about. This is a good result for Andre DeGrasse. Yep. The time was, let me just check because I don't know if they came through at the
1982-1.
Right? Yeah, 1982-1, and I believe his was 1989.
It's a good meet for him, Jeff. You know, yeah, bronze in the 100, silver in the 200 after, you know, coming back from injury. That I think, and he said this himself, I think after the 100, he's really setting himself up, I think, perfectly for Tokyo.
Yeah. Congratulations to Andre DeGrasse, and as people have said, this is an important World Championships because it dovetails nicely with the prep schedule for a lot of runners going into Tokyo. But you're right, this is a good way for him to end his the individual season.
You know,
good time.
Somebody like Adelbaut will have a much better, much more educated opinion. But it strikes me that his better shot for gold, Jeff, is the 200. Christian Coleman seems very, very tough to beat in the 100. I could see Andre, though, getting double silver or maybe silver gold, depending on the Lyles in the 200. But that's a great meet for him. He has to be totally satisfied with his results here.
As I mentioned, we do have an Amber Alert. Niagara Regional Police have issued an Amber Alert for Evelyn, Matthias, Sovereign, Eska, and Magnus McDermott. They are 5, 10, 11, 13, and 14, respectively. Last seen September 19th in Jordan, Ontario. Their suspect is Father Ian McDermott, believed to be driving towards Toronto in a gold pickup truck. And you are asked to call 911 if you have any info. So again, that is a gold pickup truck, believed to be driving towards Toronto. Again, call 911 if you have any info. And if you're on the road, of course, you'll see all the Amber Alert signs along the various, the 400 series of highways. To get us back to Andre DeGrasse, that is a great result for him. And it's been an interesting meet. Christian Coleman ended up running despite not taking his drug test, and he really laid down a marker.
Oh yeah, he looked good.
And it was interesting hearing his coach speak afterwards about, you know, this is a guy whose training has kind of been messed up because of all this. And yet he was still able to lay down that time. So we look forward to
and I think the race that Otto pointed out about that would be the 400 hurdles, that happened, right? And that was a pretty tight race, I think, between those three people that we cited. So it's, you know, the thing, Jeff, always is like that World Track and Field Championships is always great. Mm-hmm. It's just, you are right. You see, and I'm sure television is trying to avoid this, but you see some of the images in the crowd and it's like, I mean, what is it? It's like, 10,000 people there. I mean, it's ugly.
It was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. And, never mind the idea of holding a marathon of 40 degree Celsius weather. Anyhow, I'm just, FIFA's going to get what it asked for with the World Cup.
I mean, the IAAF's horrible, but again, compared to the IOC and FIFA, they're, Mother Teresa.
A reminder that we have Leafs home opener tickets and they could be yours. Tune in all day tomorrow for your chance to qualify for our grand prize draw. On Wednesday morning, the leadoff, our new morning show, will announce a qualifier's name. And if it's you, you'll be given 590 seconds to call back to win the tickets. You can qualify now if you're the fifth caller through at 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, or *590 on your cell. And again, stay tuned the rest of this show for more chances to win. And as we mentioned, the tickets will be given away on Wednesday morning. Elliot Friedman is Hockey Night in Canada's NHL analyst, also with the NHL and Sportsnet. Elliot Friedman joining Richard Deitch and myself in primetime. So, Mr. Friedman, one more sleep, and the puck has dropped. You're ready for this, I presume. I saw you on the Hockey Central preview. You were complaining about having to do predictions. So as soon as I saw that, I thought, okay, Friedman's ready. Get it going.
When I'm complaining, you know I'm in mid-season form.
Exactly. Well, yeah. You're consistent about your predictions. You do not like doing predictions.
No, I hate them. I really hate them. And not just because I'm always wrong. I just, if I could predict things, I would be predicting lottery numbers and I wouldn't be here right now. I'd be on an island with no social media accounts and nobody would ever hear from me again.
It's interesting, Elliot. Because I certainly respect your viewpoint on this, but fans love them. They love predictions. They love lists. They love this. It sort of speaks to fantasy hockey. People can't get enough of them. You could do segments every week on a prediction of something.
Well, I think, yes, they do. They gobble it up. And if people are interested, then you have to do them. Right, Richard? There's no question about it. And at the beginning of every year in my notes, and I'm working on them for tomorrow, I do like to pick a couple of teams who I think are completely under-respected, who are going to have good years. And I've had I've had success at picking those teams before, and I've been disastrous at picking those teams before. But the funny thing is there are people out there who like to remind you of your terrible picks. There's some of my buddies, they've heard things I've said over the years that have turned out to be completely untrue. And whenever I say something to them, they'll be like, is this more or less accurate than your prediction of this particular thing, which turned out to be a complete disaster?
See, that's just not fair.
But that's what friends are for, right? They're there to remind you of all the horrible things that you've done in your life.
Jeff, I think you both know this. I don't know how many people in the audience know, but if you happen to be on Twitter, there is an incredible account called Old Takes Exposed, which lists sports writer predictions sports analyst predictions or columns. And it's just like, you'll read the Jordan draft. Michael Jordan will be a failure. What a terrible pick by the Bulls. I mean, it's fantastic. Fortunately, I haven't been burned on there too much, but I do. I mean, you and Jeff will appreciate this. I do have a tweet out there where I said, like, the Bucks pick of Roberto Aguayo, the kicker in the second round, will be game changing. He's going to win a ton of games for the Bucks. He's the greatest college kicker I've ever seen. He was cut literally, I think, a year into his tenure and has not been seen since. So we've all had these.
Yeah. We all have those. Yes.
Before we talk about the season ahead, I wanted to ask you about Gary Bettman's some of the things he said today, in particular, yep, in an interview about. He was asked about escrow, but mostly about front loaded contracts. I wanted to ask you this, Elliot. Look, front loaded contracts are, I mean, it's how teams like the Leafs work. Why does he hate them? Like, why would Gary Bettman hate them?
Why would he hate them? Because I think the one thing about this commissioner is he has fought hard for some of the weaker links in this league.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, you know, I mean, how many times have people said that Arizona will be a failure?
Right.
And he has fought hard to do it.
Brought hockey back to Winnipeg.
You know, early in his career, he was ripped for not doing enough to save Canadian franchises. He brought it back. And, you know, he's exhibited a lot more patience with the current ownership in Ottawa than I think a lot of people would, you know, ever expect. Once he decides he's going to fight for something, he fights for it. And, you know, I think that he believes that, you know, there's too many owners and teams that don't think they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And in this part of the argument, I am against the commissioner. You know, to me, the salary cap was there to hinder the Torontos, the Rangers, the Flyers, the Canadians of the world, even the Canucks of the world. And so if I was them and I own the Maple Leafs and someone said to me, okay, well, you brought the cap in. Yes, I can make more money, but I can't throw money at everything I want to throw money at. So this is what I'm going to do to sort of take advantage of the loophole. But he just philosophically disagrees with that. He hates it. He brought it up last year at the Board of Governors meeting in Vegas, and he was emphatic about it. I think he would did it again this year at the Board of Governors meeting, which was a couple of weeks ago. I think he was upset about it again. He hates it, and he's going to try to stop it. I just don't know if that's going to happen as part of this CBA. Like, that might be one CBA away. I think it's too big a battle to fight against the players right now, because it's a big victory for them.
Elliot, I want to ask you about sort of the state of the league as we head towards this year's regular season. You take a macro look, and a little bit of this is sort of U.S. based. They're in a great position with a new franchise coming in Seattle, which I think is going to be an absolute hit. They have labor peace, which at least for a couple of years, which is huge. And here's the big one, Elliot. They are sitting, I think, on a gold mine when it comes to the U.S. television rights deal that's coming up. One,
it looks like it.
Right. The postseason numbers were very good. Regular season numbers off last year were flat. But here's the thing, Elliot. Not only do they have the incumbents in NBC, they have so many new kind of digital and streaming players in the states like DAZN, et cetera. It would strike me that the NHL is looking at a great, great media deal coming up simply because I think there's just going to be a lot of suitors who want their content and inventory.
Well, that is the belief. I do think that one of the major reasons that the CBA was extended by the players, or they didn't go through with their opportunity to reopen it, is the belief that there is going to be a significant burst in the U.S. media rights in 2 years. And, you know, obviously people believe that NBC is going to extend, but they're going to give up a small part of the package to a secondary partner over the air, which may be ESPN. But there is also, I think a number of us are wondering if there is going to be a digital streaming partner, whether it's Amazon or DAZN, you know, mm-hmm. or something like that. You know, we don't know, but I think we're all curious to find out exactly what that's going to be. I think the other question that's going to be interesting, Richard, is, you know, the United States is coming off a 10-year deal. You know, our deal is a 12-year deal.
Right.
I think there's people who think the NHL is going to go shorter with this one.
It's interesting. The one thing I would point out to you and Jeff Elliott, and I think you certainly, Elliott, you know this, is I think the NHL will create a streaming deal for this reason alone. These new players in the market like DAZN honestly are willing to pay a absurd premium just to just to be part of the like the big four or five sports rights. So I think I think Bettman's calculation is correct. I think he's going to be able to get a ransom for that streaming deal simply because I think these companies want in major sports, which as a general rule are just, they don't come to market often.
That's true. I think you're right. Like until we know, we don't know, but I think you're right. I'm curious about the term of the deal. Like I said, I've had some people tell me they think that this might turn out to be a shorter term deal because, you know, we really don't know where we're going and they don't necessarily want to undersell their rights. So, you know, we'll see. I don't know the answer to this question. I'm very curious about it, but I've heard all the same things you've heard. I think, Richard, though, like, I think one of the biggest changes we're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years is I believe there's going to be a push to have the players out there more. You know, very quietly last week, you know, there was an announcement by the NHL that they're getting into partnership with a social media platform to have players put things out there. And, you know, I had some people who told me that very quietly that was a pretty significant story that didn't get a lot of play because that is not something even 3 or 4 years ago they think the NHL would have considered. So I believe we are heading into a new era. Like these young players, they've just proven over the last year that they're not afraid to flex their muscle when it comes to contract negotiations. They have moved the bar. They've changed the pay structure of the National Hockey League. So I think that people are very curious to see what they're going to be willing to do with their personalities. And I really do think if the NHL wants to move the ceiling for what it can be, it's going to be on the players to do that with their selves.
Elliott, you look around the Canadian-based NHL teams, and I know you guys did this on the Hockey Central preview. You look around at the Canadian-based NHL teams. Which Canadian-based NHL team is the most puzzling to you right now? Like which team could go in any direction?
I think that's a great question, Jeff. I think Toronto's going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
I think Calgary's still going to be pretty good, although I think they have some. I think they're interested in, curious about, I don't think anybody's expecting Calgary to finish second in the league again, but I still think they're going to be good. I would say that the teams that, I think the one of the more interesting ones is Winnipeg, because I get the sense that a lot of people don't think they're going to be as good as I think they're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bufflin being away is huge, and we'll see how that all works out. But when there's a lot of people there who don't think there's like when I've said a lot that I think Winnipeg's a Stanley Cup contender. Now, again, that's questionable a bit more now because Bufflin's not there. But I have a lot of people who really disagree with me on that. So I think they're kind of being disrespected a bit. I still think they're really talented. I still think they've got a lot of ability, but if there's one team in Canada that's expected to be, that I think is expected to be good, that most people, they say they'll be fine, but in that division, they're not as good as I think they are, it's probably the Jets.
Elliott, I want to ask you about two teams that obviously Leaf fans care a lot about, and that's the Lightning and the Bruins. One, do you expect the Lightning to sort of run off and hide again as they did last year? And the second one I think might be more interesting because in reading thoughts and stories from people, preseason stories about the Bruins, there does seem to be a little bit of a difference in opinion. Some believe, obviously, they're you know, one of the top three or four teams in hockey, Stanley Cup contender again. And then there are others who surmise that they may take a step back and that the Bergeron sort of Marchand era is going to start to head the other way. How do you see those two teams?
I don't buy that at all. Okay. I don't buy that at all. I mean, you know, Richard, chances are you're right that they're going to take a step back because the only step forward is winning the Stanley Cup, right? So, you know, the odds are with you if you're wagering, if you're putting the money down. But you underestimate that team at your own peril. They're pros, man. They always prepare right. They have the right attitude. You know, regardless of what you think about some of the stuff Marchand does on the ice, like him, Bergeron, Chara, even the younger guys, the McAvoys, the Krugs, the Krejcis, the Pasternaks, those guys are pros. They prepare a certain way. They're always ready. They're disciplined. They do what they do. They show up much more often than they don't. I'm happy to put money on the Bruins to be good 100 times out of 100. I think the Lightning, I think they're really talented. You know, I could see, again, I think the regular season, I think they may step back a bit because stepping up is setting another NHL record for wins in the season. And I don't know if that's going to matter as much to them as it did last year. But I still think they're going to be really good. I think the biggest difference in that division, Richard, is the last 2 years we've known by January who's making the playoffs.
Right, right.
I don't think that's going to be the case this year. I think Florida's going to be better. And I think the Maple Leafs will be better. I think they're going to be interesting to watch. I think there could be a lot of 8-6 games, which is fun to watch. But, you know, I think Toronto's going to be better. I think they're going to have the puck a lot. And, you know, I know it was Detroit, and they're not going to be very good. But if you watch that power play last Saturday night, it's going to destroy people. And yeah. So I think it's going to be a great division to watch this year.
No, again, you made the point during the preview that, I mean, my goodness, the number of options that Mike Babcock has on the power play now, you know, is just staggering. And they've, mm-hmm. they've effectively got two full units, don't they? That'll be better. Their second unit will be better than a lot of teams' first units. And that
it will be.
That's frightening.
Mm-hmm.
St. Louis, what do you make of the Blues and what they've done in the offseason? And I mean, they're in a tough, tough, tough division. Do you see any way they repeat? And again, I know that's, I'm asking you, yeah. Puck hasn't even been dropped in anger yet, but can you see the Blues? Do they look to you like a team that might be able to repeat?
I think the interesting thing is, like this Pietrangelo thing, it's quietly one of the more fascinating stories of the early season. So they go out and they get Falk and they sign him to an extension, and now they've got Pietrangelo playing on his weak side, although he can move around. I know someone who was watching them the first time they played together, him and Falk, and they were like, okay, they were kind of alternating or moving around depending on who, what happened or how quickly they got on the ice. I think one of the reasons they went out and they got Falk was because they wanted to be better this year. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Doug Armstrong subscribes to the theory that even if you win a championship, you kind of have to jolt your team if you want to repeat. You have to do something, bring in somebody who hasn't won before, or do something to shake off any kind of malaise off your team. And I think he makes them better for this year. But there's no question that, you know, this Pietrangelo thing is interesting. You know, if I was talking to another GM about it, and he said he finds it hard to believe that they can't make a deal, that the only way that Pietrangelo and the Blues can't make a deal is if for whatever reason, someone there doesn't want them to make a deal. But there's no question that the longer that goes on, this team overcame a lot of distractions last year to win. I think that's going to be an interesting early season storyline for them. They come to Toronto in the first week, and I think there's going to be a meeting at that time between team and the representatives at Newport. I mean, it could be interesting because that's going to be a season-long storyline if he isn't signed.
Elliot, who do you think will be the most impactful rookie this year and why?
Well, there's a lot of good ones. I mean, I think Cale Makar has a chance to be that guy. I think the first two picks have a chance to be that guy. You know, Sportsnet.ca did a really good piece today breaking down some of the contenders for the Calder Trophy, and someone sent me a note and said there's one guy that you guys didn't put there, and I said, who's that? And he said, Adam Fox from the Rangers. And they said that he's going to get power play points. I think Makar has a chance to be the most impactful guy, and because they're a team that's going to have a chance to win the Stanley Cup, I think. And he had the head start of the first few games in the playoffs last year. So it's a bit of an advantage for him. But if I had to pick someone, I'd probably pick him.
Reeds, we're going to let you scoot. Appreciate you doing this, my friend, as always.
All right, boys. Have a good night. Enjoy the first night tomorrow.
Absolutely. You take care. You too, Elliot.
Don't get bored by anything Berkey says, okay?
Oh, that never happens. Don't worry. Take care. Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada and the NHL and Sportsnet. And they had a fun during the Hockey Central preview. I just love Burke's reaction. Like they had Merrick and Elliot, and you know, they'd throw a team out there, and you know, they would talk about this, and Burke would go, "Well, I don't have them as a playoff team." just the way
I love Brian Burke's interplay with Elliot, and I love Brian Burke's truculence on air. He's very fun to talk to. He's been in the studio many times. He's one of my favorite guests. But he's such a I don't know if character is like the right word, Jeff, but he's you know what it is? He's got such a presence on TV that he's fun to listen to.
Well, and he's done everything.
True. Yeah, well, you know,
he's literally winning a Coach of the Year award. Right. But I mean, he's You look at his background between the NHL office, player agent. I mean, he was a player. He's a lawyer.
Yeah. But you can't have a presence unless you have that resume, right? Like,
yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's sort of part of it. But yeah, he's. I mean, you know, he's one of those guys that when I heard he was going to be on television or in the media, I sort of thought it would be can't miss just for that reason alone. It's going to be fun to hear those guys.
Yeah, I'm with Elliot. I think Colorado is going to be a real trendy pick for the Stanley Cup. I don't think they're good enough to win the Stanley Cup, but man, they are good enough to go to the conference final.
You don't want
to
get suckered because they're a hot team, but they got a great first line. They have as Elliot said, I think they have the favor for the Calder. They get good goaltending. That team's going to be good.
Yeah.
Nazem Kadri is in a really good spot.
He landed in a terrific spot. If you were going to pick a team for Nazem Kadri to be on, and I mean, a team where his talents and his skills are so needed. And I think he's going to be such a great player in the Western Conference. Yeah. I really do. I that was one of those deals at the time it was made where I looked at it and I thought this helps both teams.
Yeah. And Kerfoot really said in this studio, right, that like it's a good hockey market.
Yeah.
Great place to play.
It's very supportive fan base. Yeah. It's a bit of a, I wouldn't say a niche market, but it's a very supportive fan base. They're going to be fascinating. And it was interesting looking at some of the preseason picks, you know, just seeing the difference and the number of different teams people have picked. People in Vegas, Colorado. A lot of people took Vegas, which really
surprised me a little bit.
It surprises me.
Did any of the Sportsnet experts take Nashville or San Jose? Did you see?
I didn't see that. A lot of them took that. And this is a team that I think might be, if I was to pick a team coming out of the West, I think Dallas is going to be really good.
I saw a lot of people picking Dallas.
Dallas is
going to
be really, really good.
Yeah, it was interesting.
But in the East, I looked around. So at some point, the Leafs are going to win the Eastern Conference. So this might as well be the year. I'm going to pick them to win. At some point,
both of us. I can't believe we're both in agreement. Both of us are picking them to get to the Stanley Cup final.
Travis says three of our experts said Nashville winning the Stanley Cup.
The Stanley Cup. Yeah. I actually don't like that pick. Did anybody from the Sportsnet, maybe Travis could look it up. I wonder if anyone from the Sportsnet group picked the Leafs to win the Cup.
I know NHL.com had a couple of people that pick the Leafs.
I know Merrick picked them to get to the final. I don't think he picked them to win.
Okay, Merrick and Rory Boylan both had them winning the cup. There you go.
Good for Merrick putting it out there.
There you go. Merrick, and you know, Merrick was the guy who made the ballsy call on Nashville. So
I mean, and I'm trying not to sort of see it through home colored glasses, but I like them this year.
Yeah, I think there's I'm trying to come up with reasons to not pick the Leafs. That's where I am with them. I'm trying to come
history,
up with reasons. The only thing,
lack of depth, right?
Well, it's history. You know what? I don't believe history plays a role in this thing. Like, do you think Rasmus Sandin gives a rat's ass about whether or not the Leafs have won since 1960? To me, it just comes down to Freddie Anderson. Is it plain and simple? Freddie Anderson stays healthy, they win the conference championship.
I don't believe in ghosts and stuff like that, Jeff. But I kind of do believe that. There, you can't have a team or a culture when things sort of become troubling and everything sort of feels negative. But the great thing about sports is, like, that can get blown up. I mean, the Cubs, you're a baseball guy. The Cubs had that forever until they won, and now they flipped, you know, into one of the best-run organizations in sports.
See, so I think I don't think that was ghosts with the Cubs. I really do believe that
they were cursed.
No, I think Dave Baseball screwed that franchise up for the longest time.
You might be right.
And that's just based on talking to guys who played there. I think Dave Baseball screwed the Cubs up more than anything else.
In that same theory, do you buy that maybe the Rangers can't win because it's too hot in Arlington? Like that kind of stuff?
I think there's an element to that.
Yeah, I buy that too.
I think guys do wear down. We will step away and be back with more. It's Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now back to Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
I want to remind you that this is your final week to nominate your hockey team to play at the Mattamy Athletic Center as part of our first annual Champions of Rec League Cup, brought to you in conjunction with the Beer Store. And you can submit nominations and find all details at sportsnet.ca/590. It's a great opportunity for your team to play at the Mattamy Athletic Complex, which is, of course, the old Maple Leaf Gardens footprint. And the game will be called by Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph, our Leafs radio crew. It'll be piped into the arena. And there'll be an after party and all sorts of good stuff. So, and again, this is not open to just teams in Toronto. So go to sportsnet.ca/590. It's your final week to enter your rec league hockey team. And as I mentioned, a chance to play at the Mattamy Athletic Center or Athletic Complex. Figure out. As I get older, I struggle with the names of arenas and stuff.
I saw curling there. It's pretty cool, actually. It's the only first and only time I've seen curling.
Curling's tremendous. I used to curl in high school. Everybody in Manitoba curled in high school.
Really? Were you...
I have a...
This will be my ignorance, but is there...
Like Manitoba's
it's like
the
a,
hot
it's like
bed
a basketball team in the way like high school curling is the same thing like high school basketball.
Yeah, you had play downs to represent your high school in the high school championship.
Wow. How many people would be on a team?
Four.
The whole roster is four.
Well, there's only four on a rink, yeah.
No, I know, but it's like you don't have backups or something like that?
Hell no.
Wow. So was it a competitive tryout to make that varsity?
Oh, yeah. You have a team of four, and you advance through the high school. You'd have to beat
the other people in the high school.
And then, depending on how it was done, you would have zone playoffs. There would be tryouts for the team, but you could also do it just simply by having your team win. That's great.
Did you get a...
I had a
curling, like a Letterman jacket or a curling jacket.
I had a curling sweater.
Sweet.
With my name in the back, you know, embossed like, and it was the felt name, the raised letters. Right. So there you go. Oh yeah, and I used a.
Did you have your own equipment, or did the school provide the?
I had my own equipment. They don't need equipment. You don't even need gloves. Gloves are for wimps. Now, and keep in mind, this is a natural rink in Manitoba. It's an indoor rink, but it's natural ice. So
I just love the fact that there's like, so you would play the other local high schools.
Yeah. Well, there's no other local high schools
one
in
other
Morden.
Local
there's
high school?
One high school in Morden. Okay. You'd play other towns.
Nice. Love that.
That was great fun.
Was it the same kind of culture where you'd have to bus very far to play the opposing team or not?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, you'd go into Winnipeg for the high school playoffs.
Wow.
It was a big deal. I actually did color commentary in curling. For a day.
At what level?
The Manitoba, the MCA Bonspiel, which is at the Winnipeg Arena, which is like all, every rink in Manitoba. If you had the money, you'd go into this competition.
Right.
And then you'd, you know, sort of be a last person standing sort of a thing. So Les Lazarek, who is play-by-play now for the Saskatoon Blades, is doing it. So, yeah, I did color one time.
And you've done color for baseball?
Yes. Yeah. Anything I mean, the hardest thing about curling back then was staying sober, to be blunt.
Well, I love that. That was one of the fun things of just watching curling, because it was much about sort of drinking hanging out as anything else.
We had a guy in our high school rink who would smoke while he was curling. It was like our third.
Like cannabis?
He'd have a heater going. No, this is 1975. With cigarettes.
All right.
Because you used to have little ashtrays in curling. So he'd sit there and he'd have a heater working.
It's amazing to me. I mean, it literally feels like another planet. But there's a famous Sports Illustrated cover of Dick Allen smoking. Have you ever seen that?
I have seen it, yes.
It's like, can you just, like, you can't even conceive that in today's athletics.
Well, Ron Washington still sneaks the odd heater in the
But could you imagine, like, seeing, like, I don't know, Kevin Durant or, like, Austin Matthews just with, like, a cigarette?
Well, with Austin Matthews, I can see Austin Matthews smoking a cigarette.
In uniform, I mean.
Oh, in uniform, no, yeah. No.
No, I'm sure guys, you know.
Jim Leland smoked while he was on the patch.
He did.
Which was still the most remarkable thing I've ever seen in my life. Because that's not good. When you're in the patch, there's one thing you're not supposed to do and smoke. It's smoke. And Jim would go, I don't really get it. I'm going to have a cigarette anyhow.
It's amazing, though. These just sort of like culturally. Yeah. But that's good. No, I find.
Curling is a
as
great
an American,
TV.
I find it so. First of all, it's phenomenal
it's
to watch
phenomenal
on TV.
It's a phenomenal TV sport.
But it's interesting to me because it's just foreign. And it's really fascinating to try to pick up the game and to figure out what makes a certain curler better than another curler. And I would say, Jeff, that if you are one of these nations that are trying to, like, move up on the podium or medal count at the Winter Olympics, if you have the ice, obviously, why wouldn't you invest in curling?
You ever notice how quickly the Chinese have become good at curling?
No surprise, right?
They spend a ton of money to bring Canadian coaches over.
Oh, so there you go.
Coach over there.
That's how you do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's my friend Dave Hyde, columnist with the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel, became a huge curling fan. He watched it at the Olympics.
Well, all these American writers fell in love with it.
In Vancouver, it was because, Cheryl Bernard, I believe, they called her the Van Cougar.
Yeah, there's always, like, some attractive, woman on
but,
the on
but
the
But Hyde fell in love with the sport at, it wasn't in Vancouver. It might have been, what happened first, Turin or Salt Lake?
Salt Lake's 2002, and then Turin is after that.
Okay, so it was Turin. He fell in love with, like, curling. And I remember him, and just, he'd go and watch it. I could time off in the Winter Olympics. You know, I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm going to go watch some curling. Just to watch." He'd go down to the venue.
I saw it in Sochi, and it was interesting to it was you know again it's as
there's
an American,
a crap load of strategy. In it.
I know,
there
and I
really
wish I
is.
Wish I understood it better, but it's very cool to just be there in person.
We also used to have jam pail curling in Morden.
What's that?
Well, it was a participation sport. It was a big weekend. Every small town had a jam pail bonspiel. And I'm sure people out there have done the same thing. The jam used to come in pails. They were like yay big, right?
Right.
So what you used to do is fill them with concrete, stick something in there that could be a handle, and you'd cut the curling rink in half, you know, and somebody would draw like the circles halfway down. And it was just a thing you did as a kid when you were like 12 years old. But it was a big thing. The whole town took part. Every kid in the town took part.
Love that.
Jam pail curling was tremendous. Got hot chocolate, a couple of hot dogs, and a donut.
We didn't
chuck some jam pails down.
We didn't have any of this stuff in New York. The stick ball and playground basketball, pickup hoops.
That's what happens when you're in a town that's only got three TVs.
People in Manitoba bowl?
No. Well, actually, there's a bowling alley in Winkler. There isn't one in Morden, but there is one in Winkler, I do believe. Bowling was kind of.
Bowling's kind of a. Bowling was a sort of a thing in New York at its moment.
Yeah. Bowling was, God, I can't remember the last time I bowled. Pool we played a lot. Everybody plays pool. We used to have a pool hall, except ours was unlicensed because that's what you did in a small town. It had pinball machines and cigarette machine, of course. Was unlicensed. Anyhow, so there you go. How the hell did we get into curling?
I don't know. I like it, though. I mean, it's real.
Why did we get into curling?
I've never been to Manitoba.
You brought it up, didn't you?
Yeah, because you mentioned the former Maple Leaf Garden, which has curling competitions sponsored by this network.
Yeah. The game is not what it used to be back when you had corn brooms and guys used to make now they just like they're like push brooms, dull corn brooms, man. You'd make noise with those suckers, and then they got these sort of synthetic corn brooms which were like fiberglass, and they had little fiberglass flaps in them. And if you were strong enough, you could make that thing. It sounded like gunshots going off in the ice. Oh, it was great. Mm. So good.
So do you find I'm going to switch topics here real quick. This is like a fascinating thing to me, Jeff, that I'm not sure I've been in a city where at least in some people's eyes, success would be determined by a second round loss, meaning that there's so much talk that, like, you know, the Leafs have to get out of the first round to get Babcock off the hot seat, or the Leafs have to get out of the first round to have a successful season. Isn't that so odd that you know what I mean? Like, I understand it's based on the history of what has happened.
I think he has,
but it's such a weird round to sort of, you know what I mean, be determined success.
I don't know if that works anymore. I think he has to go to the Stanley Cup, or he's gone.
I don't think a second round. I don't think anybody should celebrate a second round defeat.
But I think if he doesn't go to the Stanley Cup, he's gone.
I think if the Leafs got to the conference final, I think Mike Babcock would be back. I mean, you'd have to see how they lost in the final, but that's pretty tough to let go of a coach who loses in a conference final. I'm not saying you're wrong. I think that would just surprise me. He's got, how many years does he have left on his deal? Two or three.
Yeah. And, you know, depending on who you talk to, the deal may or may not be front end loaded. Everybody said that the deal's front end loaded and that most of the financial hit has already been taken.
The other thing,
but there are other people who say that's not the case.
Other thing I was going to ask you is, do you think this year is a referendum on Babcock or Kyle? Because because how the team is constituted, it really is now Kyle's vision and Kyle's team as to how an NHL team should be composed.
Oh, that's a good question. Last year wasn't a referendum on Kyle. I think this year is.
I think that's fair.
Having said that, I think, I don't know if this makes sense, but I think Kyle has a longer leash than Mike Babcock.
For sure. He's been in his position less time.
And,
right?
And I would argue that Brendan Shanahan's reputation is linked more to Kyle Dubas than Mike Babcock, because Babcock was the best coach available. So essentially, if you're Brendan Shanahan, you hired, Lou Lamoriello was a GM, but me, Brendan was involved. You guys went out and hired the best coach out there. Picking Kyle Dubas over Lou Lamoriello, that's Brendan Shanahan kind of putting his ass in the slinger at that point, you know? Right. So I think in a lot of ways, his reputation is tied to what Kyle Dubas does.
Mark Hunter. I mean,
to a certain degree, Mark Hunter. It's a fascinating dynamic.
I think you're totally right. I mean, regardless of what the result will be, Kyle will be here next year.
Yes.
But I think at this point now, I think whatever the Leafs will be in the next couple of years is ultimately a referendum on how Kyle Dubas believes a team should be built, clearly speed, skill, and it'll be very interesting if, and obviously I don't think anybody hopes for this, but if they don't have success, what that would mean for him in the next couple of years. Like, I think you're totally right. I think Brendan Shanahan has sort of tied everything to Kyle.
Yep.
And if it doesn't go the right way, that's a pretty interesting discussion. I happen to think it's a really good team and it's going to work out.
No, I do as well. I mean, I don't know.
So Mike Babcock, I think
I don't know why I'd be lying if I said I followed every offseason NHL move, but I'm with you. I think this is a really good team. It's the most balanced Leafs team, I mean, I've seen since I've been in this city.
I was just going to say, if you read a season previews by really good NHL analysts, particularly ones with an analytic bent, they all have the Leafs in the top three teams in the league. Mm-hmm. Of course, the problem is a lot of times the Bruins and the Lightning are there too.
Yeah.
But this is a top three team, in my opinion.
And so, as we've said, I think we both agree that with everything that's said, Freddie Anderson hurts his groin. They're screwed.
By the way, I know the likelihood of this is not going to happen, but could you imagine if this city went back-to-back on an NBA champion and a Stanley Cup champion? Back-to-back years?
No. I can't, because I can't imagine it.
It's probably too hard to contemplate.
I can't imagine
God, how great would that be?
You know, actually, yeah, I can actually imagine that. It's not, it's the first time that it has not been out of the realm of possibility in my mind for the Leafs to win the Stanley Cup. Even last year, I think, you know, you kind of pick it, if you picked the Leafs to win the Stanley Cup last year, you did just because it was like, you know, it's like the thing you, it's like turning legal drinking age and finally being able to drink. You had to do it because you waited so long to pick the Leafs to win the Stanley Cup and be able to do it without people saying you're a lunatic, that when it finally came around, you jumped on it. This year feels a little different, though. This year feels like there's more meat. There's more meat. There's more heft behind that particular selection.
Can we broadcast that live show from the parade? Can we make that happen, you think?
I don't know if I can handle another parade. I really don't. I don't know if I can handle another parade. It'd be interesting to see the difference between a Leafs parade and a Raptors parade.
I think the Leafs parade would have less people. Are you going to tell me I'm crazy or no?
Nope.
Yeah, that would be mine. Not to say it wouldn't be impressive, but I don't think you can duplicate what we saw last summer.
No, that was so this summer. Totally. That was just so totally galvanizing, and it's almost as if it came suddenly, and even during the parade, it was almost hard to believe that the Raptors aren't viewed in the NBA the way the Leafs are viewed in the NHL. The Leafs have always been viewed as the team that is just so star-crossed, that should have won the Stanley Cup, and that just, you know, they've got so much money and yada yada. And the Raptors are different.
Well, the other thing,
were different. The franchise was never expected to win.
Right. The other thing, too, is, like, it was a celebration throughout the country. If you're in Winnipeg or Calgary or Vancouver, you may not be a big basketball fan, but you don't hate the Raptors. No. Obviously, you'll have no interest in a Leafs parade in those cities.
No. You're absolutely right.
You know, there's, like, a Galvin, and I'm not saying that people traveled necessarily from other places to Toronto for that parade, but you felt that it felt like a countrywide celebration. Where I think the Leafs would really feel like a city celebration.
Yeah, the Raptors and the Blue Jays are the only two Canadian-based brands in their respective leagues.
Right.
And there is an attachment to them. Now, there are Leafs fans in every NHL city, but there are Leafs haters in every NHL city. And you're right. I can safely say there will not be a Maple Leafs viewing party in downtown Winnipeg if the Leafs go to the final. I can safely say that. And I don't know if there is a Canadian team. You know, I think maybe Winnipeg is the only Canadian team that would kind of be able to unify people. First of all, because every city's full of at least, you know, at least 30% of their population's from Winnipeg, because there's this great sort of diaspora from Winnipeg. But I think that's the only team, because of the history, losing hockey in the city, hockey coming back, you know, the little team that could, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Nobody really hates Winnipeg. Calgary hates Edmonton. Edmonton hates Calgary. You know, Vancouver, I don't know. Montreal hates Toronto. Ottawa hates Toronto. Everybody hates Toronto. Everybody hates Ottawa.
Yeah.
But nobody really has a hate on for Winnipeg.
That's an interesting observation. I
think they're the only NHL team that could, if they went to the final, that would unify the country.
Love to see it. I'd like to see some Canadian teams go deep.
But it won't happen because the Leafs will be. Leafs will be in the final.
Dallas, Toronto.
Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro held their media availability today. Some of it was on the record. Some of it was off the record. Let's see if Shai Davidi can keep a secret. I bet he can. It's primetime on Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Good show, good podcast. Subscribe to podcasts of Good Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back to Primetime Sports.
It is unbelievable the motivational speeches that you give prior to hitting that mic on button. I mean, I'm so ready to go out and conquer the world after your last soliloquy.
Oh, God.
My God.
Come on. If we can't kid each other.
That's true.
Who can we kid?
That's my mom's a shrink. Like, let me tell you, that was interesting.
That actually was I have to admit.
Without saying exactly what Blair said.
Even by Blair.
Let's just say it was literally the worst go out there and get him kid speech I've ever heard.
Even by my standards.
By your standards, that was depressing as hell. That was like,
oh God.
Like the Darth Vader wins Star Wars and everybody's dead. Now go out there and win one for the Gipper.
I'll tell you what. I can't. 2 to 5 can't come soon enough, can it?
When is that? That's soon.
Right? October. Travis, when is it? When is October 14th? October 15th? Thanksgiving Monday.
All right. Got some words on that.
What's Jeff Azzopardi in there? What are you showing him?
Former primetime sports ace producer Jeff Azzopardi. Now in management.
There you go.
I don't know what's going on in the behind the scenes, though, today.
I don't know.
There's a lot of excitement in our studio.
There certainly is. All right. Let's bring in Shai Davidi.
Speaking of
our MLB insider in Sportsnet. So, Davidi, tell me the best off-the-record stuff you heard, but don't tell me who it was from.
I wish there was something super exciting to share right now. I think it was a lot of caution in their comments. I think both Mark Shapiro, Ross Atkins were trying to convey a message that they're going to be making some moves while trying to manage the expectations of what those moves are going to be. And I think to me, that was sort of the prime takeaway. I thought the most interesting comment on or off the record was, you know, Ross Atkins trying to set this up as an offseason similar to the one like after the 15 or 16 seasons in terms of the types of free agent contracts they might be handing out. And, you know, the biggest deal at that time was 3 years and $36 million for Jay Happ after the 15 seasons. So
right.
That's probably the creamy middle tier where we can expect the action to happen.
I like the way you describe that, the creamy middle tier.
Nice. Yeah,
makes me want to run out and buy my season's ticket, I'll tell you that.
So, yeah, come see the creamy middle tier. So, you know, I had this conversation with Blair, and I think he's sort of dead on in that, like, you know, these guys can only say so much. You don't know what the free agency is going to be. You don't know if they've talk to their coaches, but I have to be honest, like, what, and I'm trying not to be super negative here, but like, why do I always feel unsatisfied after hearing from Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro on some kind of State of the Union? And I'm not saying like I need
you're a cynic,
I guess. And I'm not saying like I need like a rah-rah, we're, you know, go out there, we're going to get them. But it just, I mean, I hate to say it. It just always feels like an unsatisfying business school lecture. That's the best I can come up with.
Yeah, it's like going to your investment advisor and him saying, pushing bonds on you, and saying, no, don't roll the dice on the exciting securities.
Don't buy Google or Apple, right? Buy this.
That's right. Be slow and steady, right?
Buy railways. Never go wrong with railways.
Exactly. Look, I think that there's a lot of conservatism in the way that they describe their planning. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think, one, publicly, they want to be very careful about not creating expectations they're not meant to meet. But also just the way that they operate, they go through these really long, extended planning sessions where, you know, they create press lists that they work off of, and they don't necessarily work in the way I think a lot of fans have gotten used to teams working, where you say, we want these three guys, and we're going to go get them.
Mm.
And they're more, you know, to use a term that they like very much, and they're much more process-oriented, whereby they'll go through different plans in different scenarios, and you know, they'll take guy number one, but they'd be just as happy with guy number two if that value makes more sense. So
I think because of that, you get this, you don't have this inspired feeling like, okay, I know what they're going to do, because they look at it and they'll just sort of let the offseason dictate to a certain degree what they end up acquiring.
Do we know, and I think you know the question I'm going to ask you because I sent you an email on it. They're both back this year, right? Like, is there any doubt that Ross is not going to be the GM and Mark's not going to be the president?
I think at this point, if you're going to make that move, you should have made it already.
Okay.
Right? Now, it's always possible that Mark Shapiro could take a job elsewhere. Mm-hmm. He's certainly had opportunities already. And there's consistent chatter that, you know, people are sniffing around him and continue to sniff around him. So that in theory could happen. But, you know, from the club end, if you were going to make a move, I mean, you'd have to do it now. You're not going to go through the entire offseason planning and then remove them from executing it just weeks before the offseason. So
right.
I would think at this point they've got this offseason in 2020, and their futures may very well be directly tied to what they do this offseason and how the team gets going.
Shai, do you find it odd that information isn't so readily available? You know, when it comes to player contracts, we all know them. I don't want to be a hypocrite here. It's not like I want somebody particularly to know, like, my contract term. But these are, you know, these are sports executives. And as a general rule, the fans and media of a said team usually know how long a general manager, you know, a COO, you know, they usually know the term of the contract. So that usually at some point is made public.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's odd, and I think to be honest, it's a little bit hypocritical that, you know, executives who want their players to perform in the public eye with the terms of their contracts fully public, hide the terms of their contracts to when they're pulling the strings behind the scenes. And I think from an accountability standpoint with your fan base, I think your fans, your season ticket holders, the people who are paying the freight, should know exactly how long that the executives running the team are in charge, and they should be able to base their decisions by knowing, or at least in part, on knowing how long the people in charge are going to be running things. And I think it's important not only from that standpoint, but people want to know when they can expect to see certain results, and often those get tied to the executive's contractual status. And I think the Blue Jays would do well by, you know, coming clean and being fully open with their fans.
I agree. Shai, pitching, obviously, discussing pitching is sexy. Discussing hitting is sexy. What is not often sexy is discussing defense. I looked at, I have it in front of me here, Fangraphs metrics. The Blue Jays defense ranked 24th overall this year. The outfield defense ranked 25th per defensive runs saved. I know they didn't talk about this today, but from covering the team, especially over the last couple of weeks, has there been any organizational thought as to how you would improve the overall defense of this team?
Well, you could start by getting an actual center fielder. You know, that would certainly help in the outfield. It has been discussed. I think part of what's going to happen is that there are going to be some improvements just from the players that they have internally getting better, right? You know, some of those outfield metrics include, you know, Socrates Brito and Alan Hansen in the outfield would certainly skew things. And, you know, I think, you know, Derek Fisher certainly has had his moments where he's tipped that the wrong way as well. You know, if they get more Lourdes Gurriel Jr. in left field, you know, that'll help stabilize that position. And he was, I believe, a positive in defensive runs saved in the limited time there. So that would help. You know, Randall Grichuk played most of the season without... or had his mobility hurt somewhat this season by a heel problem he had last winter. So he should project better in right field next year. You know, if they get a center fielder, that would certainly help things out there. from a shortstop perspective, Bo Bichette should be just as good, maybe even on some defensive metrics, he rates better than Freddie Galvis. You know, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. can take a bit of a step forward at third base, and you have Kevin Biggio continue to make progress at second. You know, all of a sudden they're a bit more of a tighter defensive outfit. So I think that it's certainly on the agenda for the Blue Jays. It's certainly a part of their considerations, but most of the improvement that's like we're likely to see next year will probably come from internal gains.
To me, one of the most interesting things I heard today was Ross Atkins so clearly shy saying that he views Bo Bichette as an above average defender. I'm not necessarily surprised that's the case. I am surprised that that's the case after just a couple of months. And I'm not disagreeing with it, but to me, I mean, we haven't talked about that enough. I think in terms of positives from this season is the fact that, at least in the general manager's mind, this guy can play shortstop. And in spring training, all we were talking about is, God, what's going to happen? Is he eventually going to have to move to second? That's a plus for this team.
It's a huge plus. And similarly to that, Jeff, and this one really caught my attention, is that for the first time I heard Ross Atkins say that he thinks Kevin Biggio can be an everyday second baseman. And that's also a significant point of progress. So, you know, those two things definitely do stick out. But, you know, with Bichette, you're 100% right. The Blue Jays had him projected to not be as good a defensive player as he was over the 2 months. And he's the type of guy who's going to continue to get better. He's athletic. He's worked on it. I think the doubts about his ability to stay in short over the past few years have really irked him and motivated him to show everybody that he's capable, just as capable in the field as he is at the plate. You know, his focus earlier on when he was younger or as a teenager was on his offense. And now that his offense is pretty solid, he's intent on making his defense just as an integral part of his game. So you're 100% right that that's a significant point of progress for this team and really one of the important factors for them.
Shai, what does going 12-13 in their last 25 games mean, if it means anything, thinking about next year?
I try not to read too much into small samples. You know, a lot's made about, you know, how they took 2 or 3 from Boston. I mean, you know, that was a Boston team that basically waved the white flag on the season and couldn't possibly have looked any less interested than they did over the course of those 3 games. And, you know, they had some good showings against the Yankees and the other clubs, but, you know, right now their depth isn't there. And I think everybody understands that, you know, that over the course of a long season, it's nice to occasionally win series, but that happens in a limited sample. And more telling is the larger sample against all those clubs. And the larger sample shows clearly that there's a lot of work to that remains. So, you know, I thought that's a good stretch. I think it sends the club, at least from a mentality standpoint, with a little bit of momentum in the off season. Perhaps it's some fuel for some players. But it shouldn't distract from the ample amount of work that still remains for this team.
One of the things Ross Atkins said earlier today, Shai, was that listing the way the team is going to go about acquiring talent, obviously the free agency, but he also mentioned trades. If you look at the core of this team, the core group that finished September, who in that core group do you think is perhaps a candidate to be traded to bring in another starting pitcher or maybe even, you know, a center fielder who can hit in the middle of the order or center fielder who can be an offensive player?
Well, I'm super intrigued by what they're going to do behind the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the one area where you look at and you say, well, they have some surplus there, you know, and they've got some depth behind Danny Jansen and Reese McGuire in the minor leagues. But if they wanted to deal one of those guys, they could perhaps get a similar player, young player, similar control and make sort of a challenge deal with one of those two guys to address another need. Mm-hmm. And that to me is an intriguing area of opportunity for them. And, you know, right now, the way things closed out the season, Charlie Montoyo said it'd be an open competition between the two behind the plate. And, you know, Ross Atkins seemed to agree with that today, but you're not really maximizing the asset if one of those guys is a AAA and one of those guys at the majors, or if you're trying to create some sort of awkward job share between two guys who have shown enough to deserve more regular playing time than that. So perhaps that's one spot where they can take a player and perhaps flip them into something that they need.
Shai, if you were going to evaluate Charlie next year, what would be the tools that you would evaluate him on?
I think his game management wasn't really looked at in a meaningful way this year. And that was largely because, you know, most of the time he was just trying to find outs, you know. And, you know, I remember joking with him before the season. I said to him, you know, I fear for you in terms of how you're going to try to find 27 outs every day, and kind of smile sheepishly. But that's definitely how it turned out. And so, you know, for 2020 to be considered a success, there has to be some meaningful progress. And if there's going to be some meaningful progress, that means some games where, you know, it's not just who's available because they haven't been overused the past few days is being brought in to pitch in the bullpen or in from the bullpen. It's a strategic decision. And we're talking more about strategic decisions instead of survival. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's where the important evaluation is going to lie. You know, it was a huge learning curve for him this year. He faced all kinds of adversity with what he had to deal with on the roster all season long, the constant churn. But at some point, you know, the strategic chops are going to come into focus and we're going to get a sense of what his in-game management is like at that point in time.
Last question from me, Shai, actually kind of a two-parter. Did Ross Atkins say anything about what their plans would be for Nate Pearson in terms of when he would be brought up? And is there a pitcher in the minor league system, whether it's Alek Manoah or whomever, a pitcher in the minor league system that these guys think can come, you know, perhaps a little faster than was originally anticipated?
Well, Ross was really guarded with Nate Pearson. He didn't offer much. But the sense that I have is that they're going to have to find a way to manage his innings again next year because he missed last year. This year he took a massive jump, got up to 100 innings before his season ended. And next year they're going to have to limit his jump. So do they do it by having him pitch limited innings at the beginning so he can get all the way through the end of September? Or do they cut him off at some point over the course of the season? That's a decision they're going to have to make. But that issue is real, and that will certainly be a factor in when we see him next year. But I have no doubts that we'll see him next season as long as he's healthy. In terms of a surprise pitcher, I would say one name to keep your eye out for is Patrick Murphy. And he would have been up this year if he didn't suffer a shoulder injury that was a result of umpires ruling a little hitch in his delivery illegal that forced him to remake his delivery, his pitching motion in season. You know, it's a power arm with a good breaking ball, pretty advanced for where he's at. And I think that as long as he's healthy, he's going to be someone who's in the conversation next spring and has a chance to really make an impression.
Shai, is this it for access for you and the media with Ross and Mark? What happens next, at least over the next couple of months? Was this sort of when it's the autopsy or the end of the year sort of recitation of the team? Is that it, or will we hear from these guys over the next couple of months at all?
Oh, we definitely will. I mean, the GM meetings are November 11th, I believe.
Okay.
So, you know, there'll probably be a bit of a period of quiet as the postseason goes on, unless there's some bit of news. And, you know, there are rules in for teams in terms of when they can make announcements during the postseason, and also some norms. So they're going to go into a period of quiet, but they're also going to head into, you know, a several week process in terms of their off-season planning. So, you know, they'll be deep into that, and as you might imagine, they won't be keen to share the details with us until later. So it's going to be a little bit quiet. I think there was a lot from their comments for people to marinate over and consider for the coming weeks. And then once the postseason ends, we'll be back at it.
Shai, it was good of you to do this. And, you know, thank you so much for your help and your availability all season. I really do appreciate it. Thanks, my friend.
My pleasure.
Great work, Shai. Thank you.
Shai Davidi, our MLB insider, Sportsnet, and sportsnet.ca will have you covered. Any breaking news involving the Blue Jays, you will read it first on sportsnet.ca. And I do think that we are going to see a more active offseason than I may have thought about a month ago. I'm not certain active in terms of big acquisitions, but I do think that there will be, I think there's going to be a real emphasis put on bringing in some stabilizing arms. I don't think you're going to go out and get a Cy Young winner this offseason. But as I say, if the Jays start next year and any more than two of the guys who finished the year in their rotation are here, that's going to be a disaster. I think you need, honestly, Ryan Borucki plus two guys who aren't in the organization now, maybe Anthony Kay, maybe Trent Thornton. Those are the guys I could see being up here.
Do you give any shot? Do you give any shot at Ken Giles returning?
Yeah, I do, because I think you can get more for Ken Giles moving him in season than you can in the off season. The market for closers tends to really sort of constrict as the season goes on. The off season, you know, especially now the way people view closers, you can get a guy in waivers who's got a great arm. I mean, the sort of one of the weird stories about baseball is there's so many good arms out there right now that you're seeing guys in waivers that throw 98, 99, 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
For them to add an impactful pitcher, you know, somebody with 2 years major league experience, let's say, it's going to take a trade of one of their prospects, maybe Simeon Woods Richardson. I'm with Scott MacArthur in this. Scott MacArthur said the day the deal was made, he thinks Wood Richardson is in here for one reason, and that's to be traded for a guy closer to the majors. I think Scotty Mack is absolutely right about that. So maybe Ken Giles plus another player gets you something, but I would not at all be surprised if you see the Jays start the year with Ken Giles and then maybe move him midway through the season.
Jordan Romano, you think next up, or somebody else?
I haven't seen enough of Jordan Romano. Would it surprise me if he starts with the team next year and is the guy that gets the ball if Ken Giles is traded halfway through the year? Not completely, but I haven't seen enough of him. You know, there are people in the organization who tell me he can close, and I would tend to go along with that. But yeah, if they move Ken Giles midway through the season, I can certainly see Jordan Romano doing that. But they've got to come up. And one of the questions Ben Nicholson-Smith asked, you know, of Ross Atkins today, Tim Mays is a guy who was by no stretch a primary guy for anybody in this team, but he logged a lot of appearances for them. Like, they need to do some major work in that bullpen. Yeah. They really need to do some major work in that bullpen. So my sense is Jordan Romano makes the team. And
I mean, I think you're right, and I think Giles probably will be dealt middle of the year. At a certain point, though, Jeff, if you are gonna be a contender, you will need a ninth inning arm. You're gonna have to figure that out.
Yeah, but then
I know usually that's an easy thing to figure out.
Well, I'm not. I don't necessarily buy that it's an easy thing to figure out argument. Only because I've seen too many guys who are really good closers make a difference. But what I think happens with Ken Giles is I don't think Ken Giles's window dovetails with Vladdy. Right. Like, if Ken Giles has another year like he had this year, he's going to be really expensive.
Yeah.
And he's getting close to free agency. So I think you could perhaps, that's the only reason. Like in my perfect world, they talked to Ken Giles about a 3 or 4 year contract this offseason. He does want to stay here. He's made that clear. He's open to having that conversation. So in my perfect world, I do that. But I just think you're,
you know, maybe one of these young, maybe one of these 25 young arms that they have, maybe who's a starter now becomes
the only guy I can see doing that. Sean Reed Foley, and okay. he doesn't have enough control. But the only pitcher in this they've run up here this year, Richard, that I've heard anybody say this guy could possibly close was Sean Reed Foley. And boy, if you've seen him on the mound, I just don't think he's tough enough mentally to close. This is a guy who, I swear to God, the more you see him pitch, it's almost like he gets younger and that you keep waiting for that experience to manifest itself in terms of maturity, and it doesn't. It's almost like he's rewinding.
Yeah, I don't see it either.
I'm not a fan. This is a guy who this year, I mean, good Lord, the opportunities he got this year. They're dying for somebody.
Yeah.
You know, we had Arden in here talking about they're dying for that good story, that good pitching story, the guy that just kind of comes out of somewhere or nowhere and answers your question. Sean Reed Foley could have been that guy. And I know he didn't impress the coaching staff with his attitude. Of course, we saw the whole thing when he went off the mound. But he's the one guy I've heard people say, hey, if you could figure what's going on between the ears, you might have a closer.
Interesting.
But I'm not entirely sold in that. But again, I think I look at this team and Ben and I had this discussion the other day. And I look at this team and I say, all right, who is off limits? If you were the Blue Jays, who are you going not trading? Vladdy and Bodemir are the only two guys.
Do you put Nate Pierce? I mean, you're talking about on the
roster. I'm talking about on the roster now. Yeah. Vladdy and Bo are the only guys.
I would agree.
I will listen on Lourdes Gurriel Jr.
So would I.
I would listen on Kevin Biggio, although this doesn't mean that I want to trade them. But I'm saying if somebody called me up and said, hey, you know, I've got a starting pitcher with 2 years major league experience who can give you 200 innings, and I really love Kevin Biggio, I'm going, okay.
Yeah, no, there's only two. I mean, I like the catchers, but I would deal them for the right people too.
I would deal either one. And you know, further to Shai's point about, we were in the media session where Charlie Montoyo said that he sees it as an open competition. You know, that would indicate, by extension, Charlie would be okay with either of those two being his everyday catcher, which, as Shai said, would lead to the next logical conclusion, why not move one of them?
Yeah.
If you can get something for it.
Absolutely.
If you can get something for it. That helps you. This is an interesting story. When did the California story, was it Friday that it broke, Richard? The
Fair Play Act?
The Fair Play Act.
What are we on today? Tuesday? I think so, yeah.
Friday.
Yep.
The state of California, Gavin Newsom?
Gavin Newsom's the governor.
Gavin Newsom, the governor of the state of California, signed the Fair Play Act. Amongst the provisions of the Fair Play Act would be it laying the groundwork for the possibility of college athletes getting paid, college athletes in California getting paid
for their likeness.
Exactly. So in other words, for their they'd be paid a fee for marketing.
Correct. You slap UCLA's quarterback on the side of your car dealership and that quarterback should be paid for that.
Right. So we're not talking about guys getting $1 million to be quarterback for UCLA.
Right.
Not yet.
Right.
We're talking about likenesses has made sense to a lot of us for decades. It has, not surprisingly, received some blowback, but it's also gotten an awful lot of support. And it's gotten a lot of support from people like LeBron James. It really seems to have gotten a lot of support from basketball players. NBA players have really lined up in defense of this. Michael McCann is Sports Illustrated's legal analyst, and he's also a University of New Hampshire faculty. He's also a director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire faculty. That's my old job, by the way. Do you know that?
Is that right?
It is. Nice. Michael McCann joins us. It's primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free.
Now back to primetime sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A reminder that we are in the last week for you to nominate your rec league hockey team to take part in the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup, brought to you in conjunction with the Beer Store. You go to sportsnet.ca/590, submit nominations, and find details as well. Your chance to play at the Mattamy Athletic Center. And I have the game called by our Leafs broadcast crew of Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph. After party, the whole thing. And again, this is not limited to teams in Toronto. So go to sportsnet.ca/590. They should do this with like fastball teams and slow pitch teams and stuff like that too. It would be fun.
I've had a lot of reads this week already, it feels like, for you. Solid work.
It's tough reading this stuff, but it's good. Keep it coming. More reads, the better.
It's good for the economy of the radio station. I will say, I learned from McCowan, there's a real art to like reading a read well that I don't think is innate. So props to you.
Got a wild card game tonight as well. Brewers and Nationals. 7:30 coverage begins.
You want to give me a pick on that?
590 The Fan.
Before we read McCowan?
It's Morrison in Ontario.
Who's the road team? That's usually how it works in the National League.
You know what? Because I've been talking them up, and because I do think there's a Montreal Expos hex working on the Washington Nationals, I'm going Bruins. I'm going Bruins over Lightning. No, I'm going Brewers.
Over the Nats?
I'm going Brewers 6-2 over the Nats.
I'm going Nationals just because I like Max Scherzer, and I'm kind of hoping he finally can
see what they were talking about in MLB Network, though. Velocity down,
I know. Anyway. Brewers are a fun team, though, right? I mean, if they advance, that's cool, too.
They are a fun team. The governor of California, Gavin Newsom, signed what is called the California Fair Pay to Play Act. He signed it into law in a Los Angeles barbershop associated with LeBron James's HBO show, The Shop Uninterrupted, which is...
God bless LeBron. He'll figure out marketing LeBron. Opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. At some point, LeBron James is going to be marketing Supreme Court justice. But anyhow, this makes it illegal for California colleges to deny student-athletes opportunities to gain compensation for the use of their names, images, and likenesses. You know why I know that's the case? Because that is the second paragraph in an article written by our guest, Michael McCann. Michael, thanks for joining Richard Deitch and myself.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
You call this a game changer. Explain that to me.
Well, California becomes the first state, Jeff, to, as you mentioned, make it illegal for a college to do something that the NCAA requires, which is not let players be compensated for their name, image, and likeness. So California is imposing a new set of rules for college athletes that go against what the NCAA requires of schools. So it puts California colleges in a position where they either follow the law, which they will, or follow the NCAA, which they won't. And because they won't, they could be kicked out of the NCAA or at a minimum limited. The NCAA has already said that they're not going to be eligible for championship games. So it's pretty significant. Look, California is obviously the fifth biggest economy in the world. It is by far the most has the largest economy in the United States. It's a major state to be removed from the equation of national college sports.
First, Mike, good to hear from you. Mike and I probably co-bylined at least 10 or 12 pieces together at Sports Illustrated.
Was his name on top?
Well, his name gave credibility to the piece, whether it was on top or
bottom. Were you the width?
Oh, yeah, always, yeah. The people could
he's wrong.
If McCann was on the byline, then I could not be attacked by the Twitter crowd.
You were his plus one.
Exactly. So, Mike, what is the NCAA's next move here? Because obviously they're going to either through legal means or elsewhere try to counter this, correct?
Yeah, that's right, Richard. So I think two things are going to happen. One is that they put together a working group co-led by Gene Smith at Ohio State and has a lot of sort of conventional institutional players. That group is charged with recommending new policies on name, image, and likenesses. And that group is due to propose a set of new rules this month. So That's the first step will be, let's see what they propose. I don't think they're going to propose what California requires, but they're going to propose something that's different than the way things are. Maybe, for instance, they'll allow college athletes to get paid for name, image, and likeness, but they can't get the money until after college. Maybe it's put into a trust or an escrow, something like that. But we'll see. Second step, as you alluded to, is the lawsuit, the fact that we will see legal action by the NCAA, possibly also the Pac-12 and the California colleges, and they're going to make a specific argument against this law. They're going to say, look, California's law adversely impacts the interstate commerce of the United States because it is forcing the NCAA in a position where it either has to change its rules or expel members from California. And to the NCAA's benefit, there's already a case back in 1993 in the same federal circuit involving UNLV basketball where the state created new procedures after that scandal, and the NCAA said, well, you can't do that. These are against NCAA rules. And the NCAA won. And that's binding precedent here. So that's going to be an important case if this plays out.
Now, is this the type of thing, Michael, where, again, I'm not understanding sort of, American law, state law versus federal law. This is a law that is specific to California. Does that carry any clout in another state? You know, for example, I don't know if would athletes in Missouri maybe feel empowered by this, and would they in turn start pressuring their governor? Do you see this going state by state, or is this just kind of a, you just had this almost perfect storm of a very progressive governor, in a state with a lot of colleges, the entertainment industry is there. Clearly he's got the weight of LeBron James and some people behind him. Does this thing have legs, or is this going to be settled first and foremost in California? And then once it's settled, we'll see where else it goes.
Yeah, Jeff, this is really interesting because on one hand, I do think, and we've already seen legislators in Florida, South Carolina, and New York propose or set to propose legislation that would resemble in some ways what California has just turned into law. The reason why that's interesting is because that's good for the NCAA, and this is why. If states come up with different rules for this topic, the NCAA has a better argument in court that there's chaos.
Right.
That states are putting new requirements on the NCAA. It's impossible for the NCAA to comply. So weirdly enough, even though there's going to be sort of incentives and you're going to see these progressive legislators in different states pursue what California did, that's going to end up arguably helping the NCAA.
Mike, just on a personal level, I certainly support this rule and certainly support the philosophy. When I heard about it, one of the things that occurred to me was the potential for Olympic athletes. Where if you take like the Katie Ledecky example, in theory, she should be able to collect all this endorsement money from swimming places, right? But yet still keep eligibility if she decides to swim in college.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Richard. And it's a great point because I think everyone's thinking about college football and men's college basketball players, but there are all these athletes who you could argue actually have a bigger stake in this because you mentioned Ledecky. I mean, there are others that their prime moment in life to earn off their name, image, and likeness is at the age they're currently in. There's no pro league for them where they're going to go on and make millions of dollars. Literally, their college years, maybe their peak earning years based on their identity rights. So for them, this law is actually, you could argue, more beneficial, more important than it isn't sort of the conventional college player, basketball, football, but it's these other athletes, Olympic sport athletes, and many women that are in a much better position with this law going into effect than they would be without it.
Layman's question, what are identity rights exactly, Michael?
So they're defined as, they're generally defined, at least in terms of this law, as the use of someone's name, image, and likeness. So obviously name, taking somebody's name and putting it onto a product. Image would be taking literally a photographic image and using it to promote a product. And then there's the likeness point, which is the interesting one. Likeness could be, for instance, a portrait of someone else or a video game avatar, right? That was in the O'Bannon case where they created these avatars of players based on real players. They didn't use the players' names, but they were clearly inspired by the player. So that would be likeness, would be a portrait or more conventionally a video game avatar.
Mike, this is like the media geek in me, but one of the first things I thought about was, would college athletes have some kind of case or argument if, let's say, an ESPN or a CBS put the graphic of, like, the Alabama quarterback or the UCLA quarterback using their names to promote that game? Couldn't I, as that athlete or certainly that athlete's representation, say you are using my likeness to sell your television product here?
You could, although there's the precedent suggests that the First Amendment in that context would prevail. And the First Amendment would be the news reporting aspect of ESPN using that person or other media companies using images and things like that. So you're absolutely right. There's an argument there, but case law suggests that the First Amendment would trump there.
Yeah, I will say I understand that. Although, let's be honest, case law is a little BS. But because they're in that situation, that's not a news that by using like the image of Zion Williamson at Duke, you're that's not a news sort of worthy thing outside of the fact that it's Zion Williamson. You know what I'm saying, Mike? They're literally using the likeness to sell the product, which is the game coming up.
Yeah, it's hard to draw. You're right. I mean, it is different. It's just hard for courts to draw lines there.
I get it.
They worry about, right, you know, limiting the First Amendment, even if it's being used in that context for not necessarily, at least certainly not entirely newsworthy reasons.
Yeah, no, and listen, working at Rogers, yeah, well, God bless the First Amendment. Let's put the graphics up for everybody.
Right.
Michael, we appreciate you joining us as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mike.
Got it. Thanks.
Thanks for having me on. Take care. Yeah. Michael McCann, Sports Illustrated legal analyst.
And if you are interested in the nexus of legal matters in sports, there literally is nobody better.
No, as I said, I mean, that was literally the article I read prep for this. And it had everything covered.
The one thing he said that sort of gives you a little bit of sort of pause for thought is that maybe the NCAA has a case based on this precedent.
Well, you do realize now that it is almost to the NCAA's benefit for this chaos to erupt. Because now I would think, frankly, whether or not you like the NCAA, I don't think anybody does, but I would imagine it would be fairly easy for them to build a case saying, hey, this is having an impact on our, on our ability to do business.
Right.
And it has to. I mean, obviously it would.
Yeah, and the interstate commerce part's interesting is just sort of like, well, we're this unifying body, and if there's one thing going on in Missouri, one thing going on in California.
And interstate commerce is, I know you've talked about it and you've dealt with it, but I mean, I know from doing some stuff on baseball's antitrust exemption, interstate commerce is just, is
very confusing,
mind-boggling.
The only thing I would say is it's just eminently frustrating to see how much money coaches, athletic directors, bowl officials make, and then to claim whenever the athletes want to get a little something, it's going to blow up the system if you do it.
I was talking, and I know we've got a minute here, I'll wrap this up quickly, but I was talking about an interview Draymond Green did in CNN this morning,
right?
And he made the point that, look, concession worker at a college game breaks their finger because of something, they can get workman's comp. The star quarterback playing in front of 100,000 people blows his knee out, got no protection there.
Right.
He may not even keep a scholarship.
And the bookstore's making $100,000 on
exactly,
his jersey.
Exactly. That's it for us. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned. We've got wild card baseball at 7:30. The Nationals and the Milwaukee Brewers. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a great night, everybody.